Hi, everybody. I'm Lisa Twersky, and here with me now is Dr. David Palkovits. Dr. Palkovits is the professor of psychology and education at the Azrieli Graduate School at Yeshiva University, and a world-renowned lecturer on the many issues, including the issue that we're going to be discussing tonight, which is trauma. And has written extensively and researched extensively and really is just such an amazing font of information for us. And I'm so appreciative that you could take the time in your extremely busy schedule to do this piece, which is specifically to a workshop series that I've been doing to try and educate college teachers, rebbetzins, lay leadership, about particular issues. And like I said, tonight's issue is trauma, which sort of tackles a broad range of things that we'll be talking about. I think that there are certain traumas that people understand why they leave a traumatic, long-lasting, years-later effects. And then there are traumas that people, even, you know, leadership and sometimes therapists, have a harder time understanding why it stays with us, why it reverberates in our lives. And we're going to start with sort of a general discussion of trauma, and then we're probably going to spend our time focusing in on why and how the harder to understand ones also follow the pattern and can affect us years later. So first of all, thank you so much for doing this. I think it's really important for our leadership to understand this issue so that they can be as helpful as possible. And so if we could start with a definition, how would you explain what trauma is or how something becomes a traumatic experience or why it is, what that means, what we're talking about?
Sure. So first of all, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me, especially to talk to such an important group. Yes. The frontline people. It's where your real help takes place. Mm-hmm. So actually, one of the ways I like to think about traumatic events is when something happens, it's so overwhelming to an individual that just the thought of it and the experience of it becomes the hot potato that then they spend a tremendous amount of time and energy avoiding. Mm. So a traumatic event is basically something so enormously overwhelming. It'll be very different. The same event happening to two different people will be processed in very different ways, depending on some of the factors we'll talk about a little bit later. Mm-hmm. The bottom line is that sometimes it's so overwhelming that it can't be digested right away. And the art of helping an individual who's been traumatized is to help them take that hot potato and gradually get it to a place where they could hold on to it, digest it, integrate it, and move on. You can never get rid of the traumatic event, but you could bring it to a point that it becomes something bad that happened to you that doesn't have to define your life.
Okay, and before we kind of get into that, because I have a follow-up question, would you say, sort of stepping back and saying, okay, we're talking to an audience and trying to help them understand, would you say that there's certain types of traumas that everyone kind of gets why that's traumatic, and then there's certain types of traumas where it's really hard for people to understand? Is there a commonality amongst those? Can we help people understand, you know, where their resistance might be or where their blocks might come up when thinking about something being traumatic?
Yeah, and I think it's very important to frame it that way, because very often we'll say, well, that happened to me. It wouldn't derail my life in the same way. So it's easy to understand an unbelievably stressful traumatic event. Like, let's say, God forbid, being a passenger in a car when there's a fatal car accident and you actually see somebody close to you dying in an accident, or the trauma of being in a terror attack And that's easy to see, and nobody has a hard time understanding how somebody could have post-traumatic stress disorder in response to such a trauma. The harder ones are to understand the lingering impact of more subtle kinds of events. Like, let's say, what doesn't seem to be horrible sexual abuse, but is, let's say, even one or two shot inappropriate touching, mm-hmm. or what happens to a child who witnesses domestic violence between his or her mother and father. And that can be equally derailing, even though it's hard to understand. And that's, I guess, what we need to talk about.
Right, right. So first, let's talk about what you might see that'll clue you in that this thing or something has created a trauma. What are those post-traumatic stress symptoms? What, you know, it's a hot potato, their hands are red because it's burnt. But what are we seeing when we talk about trauma and, sure. and maybe seeing somebody struggling? What tells us, maybe that's a trauma-related something?
Right. So if you're talking about classic post-traumatic symptoms, so it's a constellation of symptoms clustering around re-experiencing, physiologic arousal, and then avoidance. So re-experience would be what we're used to hearing about or maybe seeing even portrayed in books or in stories or movies, where you literally have flashbacks to what happened, kind of impinge on you. Mm-hmm. Where you feel like you're reliving it. I saw just last week a young man who had been in a horrible terror attack in Israel, where he saw a very close friend of his right next to him die. It could have just as easily have been him. Mm-hmm. And he told me about just recently, he was driving his car down the highway in on the Belt Parkway in Brooklyn, mm-hmm. and he heard a car backfire, and he literally nearly drove off the road because he was still in such a hyper-aroused state. Mm-hmm. He felt like he was reliving the whole thing over again. So those are the kind of re-experiencing phenomenon, and they feel very real sometimes, and they could really interfere with functioning. Then there's physiologic arousal, where sometimes after a horribly traumatic event or series of events, you know, the individual might have trouble sleeping, or might be constantly kind of in a place of physiologic hyperreactivity. Mm-hmm. And I'm just thinking of, I'm here in my office, and I'm thinking of somebody I saw a number of years ago who had been through a sexual assault, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And when I opened the door to my office to let her in, because I saw it through the window, and she didn't realize I saw her through the window, she literally startled, you know, mm-hmm. like, and then there's avoidance. When you avoid anything that might possibly remind you of the trauma, it might be avoiding, you know, going out in the street even, because the smell of the fumes of a bus, they remind you of having been in a terrible car accident on a bus. And when you start to avoid what you used to do, and it starts to take over your life, that's a sign that you really have somebody who's traumatized that would benefit from treatment.
Right, right. And do we understand yet why two people can have similar events, traumatic events, or events happen where one will be traumatized and one will seemingly not be traumatized? Like, what's going on? How does that work?
Yeah, it's such an important question, because it's sort of like, what are the ingredients of resilience, mm-hmm. and what predicts it? So that's a very complex question, but just to take a stab at it a little bit. So we know that certain people are more likely to respond with post-traumatic stress disorder than others. So, for example, mm-hmm. women more than men. Mm-hmm. In repeated research studies, mm-hmm. people who are wired in a way that they're anxious are much more likely to respond with trauma. So, for example, for a number of years, I worked with victims of 9/11, or children who had lost their parents in 9/11. And what we found was the people who needed the longest term psychological care were the people who beforehand were the, you know, in that segment of the population, it's about 1 in 6, who are just nervous people. They're wired in a way, they're anxious. They have that kind of basic temperament. So there's the biology. There's also the other component, which is, have you had a history of many other traumatic events take place, but especially, what's your environment like? Are you surrounded by the protective shield of loving parents, loving family, a loving community? Then you're less likely to respond with PTSD. But let's say you're living in an environment where there isn't such a protective shield. You're not being held by the love and support of family and community. Then you're more likely also to have post-traumatic stress disorder when another wouldn't. One more thing, if I could just illustrate something with a fascinating vignette I heard from a colleague. There was a school shooting in Los Angeles, I think it was in 1991. Mm-hmm. A bunch of kids were pinned down by the gunfire on the playground. And a colleague of mine, Dr. Bob Pinus, who's a psychiatrist, a trauma specialist at UCLA, he found 2 9-year-old kids who were exactly the same level of proximity to the shooter. One had severe incapacitating post-traumatic stress disorder, and the other kid seemed totally fine. So Dr. Pinus met with the kid who was totally fine and said, listen, you're doing great. It was a pretty tough kind of incident there. What's going on? You know, why are you doing so well? And immediately said, I know exactly why. He said, I'll tell you why I'm fine with this. He said, a week before the shooting in my community, I went to an earthquake preparation course. And they told me, and they told my family, if you're ever in an earthquake, here's what you have to do. Run and take cover, and you'll protect yourself by doing that. When the shooting started, he said to himself, well, this is a little bit like an earthquake, and he dove for cover. Now, he was no safer than the boy next to him. In fact, he was in mortal danger, but he felt protected and prepared by the community and by his parents who brought him to the earthquake preparation course. So sometimes it has to do with kind of being prepared and being given coping skills by your community in a way that could really help you say to yourself, hey, I can handle this. And that can make an enormous difference as well.
It reminds me of an article I once read. I remember the title, I'm not sure who wrote it, called Shattered Assumptions, that where somebody who goes along and comes up against something that they didn't believe could ever happen to them is going to feel more shaken by that than the person who, he didn't expect a shooting, but he did, was oriented to the fact that a bad thing could happen, and he was given some tools to handle it. So
it was a book by Dr. Ronnie Janoff Bullman. She wrote this wonderful book called Shattered Assumptions. Mm-hmm. And I think it's interesting in terms of for the women listening to this to think about. She says that most people are born with a belief that they're pretty invulnerable, that good things, that if you're good, you're going to be okay.
Right.
If something bad happens to you because somehow you messed up. Mm-hmm. And then our, you know, fantasies about vulnerability get messed up by some kind of traumatic event.
Right.
And then she talks about how part of the healing comes from recognizing, okay, in fact, we're all on the Gesher Tzar Ma'od. Mm-hmm. We're all on that narrow bridge. And there are certain ways that you could rebuild a person's sense of stability.
Mm-hmm. Right, the sense of control of the environment, you know, after the fact, right? And maybe we'll get into that a little bit when we talk about sort of appropriate role or reaction to a revelation of trauma, you know, to the college teacher or Rebbetzin or lay leadership. But first, let me ask you sort of, you talked about the physiological response, are there other parts of us, you know, that get sort of affected by the, especially the longer term ongoing sorts of trauma that happen? Are there things that get changed and how do we understand that process or what's going on exactly?
Right, that's a very important issue to think about. And that's, there's a concept. So I told you about post-traumatic stress disorder in response to a horrific event or a traumatic, mm-hmm. overwhelming event. But what happens when you have, let's say you're working with women, either in as a college teacher or as a, in your role as, working in a mikveh, wherever it is, and whatever counseling role you're working in, who's been the victim of ongoing, really tough kind of environment. It could have been living in a family with ongoing emotional abuse, it could mm-hmm. be ongoing sexual abuse, it could be witnessing domestic violence. It's not an event, it's a process. Mm-hmm. And then something called complex post-traumatic stress disorder is what's more likely to come. Mm-hmm. And what we find, actually I was privileged in being on the team that first developed that concept for the diagnostic manual that mental health people use. And what's been found in a series of research studies, I'll recommend the book for you guys a little bit later when we come to that question. Mm-hmm. But what was found was it's a little bit of a different constellation of symptoms when you're still living in the middle of a hurricane. So if you're working with a young woman who's a Kala, and she comes from a very unstable background, where she wasn't surrounded by that sense of stability and love. Mm. Or somebody who grew up with ongoing abuse that maybe nobody even knew about, or ongoing terrible shalom bias problems. So there the following symptoms take place or a risk for taking place. You don't have to memorize them. I just want you to think of a cognitive map of what to look for. One is very often what you see is the sense of yourself as being damaged. Feeling broken, feeling like almost unfixable, feeling like people could look at you and say, well, this person is really not worthy. So it's a core sense of damage that could take place. Another thing that could take place is not just damaged systems of self, but also damaged relations with others, difficulty trusting, difficulty really being able to even trust, let's say, a future spouse. Mm-hmm. Touch you guys as mentors and supporters to trust. So it's the issues with trust. That's number two. Number three is affect dysregulation. When you grow up in a background that doesn't teach you how to self-soothe and how to calm yourself, you may have problems with temper control. You may have problems with modulating your sexuality in terms of in either direction. You mm-hmm. may have problems in general with controlling strong emotions. Mm-hmm. That's something that we often see. And then the two other areas that are particularly likely in complex trauma, again, with ongoing abuse or trauma as process, not event, mm-hmm. is somatic complaints. The body keeps the score. Mm-hmm. So maybe a lot of vague complaints, physical complaints, stomach aches, headaches. Very often that's what happens, and you see a lot of it. It could be women who have all kinds of, it could be chronic fatigue, it could show itself in a variety of ways. Mm-hmm. And literally an embodiment of the trauma being carried on in one's body. And then finally, something particularly important for you guys, for your population, it's called systems of meaning. Meaning, what does it do to your emuna? What does it do to your belief in rabbis and rebbetzins?
In God.
And very often that gets chipped away. And it's very sad, because who needs to have that strong emuna and people who have such a tough life? Yet sometimes that becomes this is why we see so many sex go off the derech, for example.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. And why does A plus B equal C? Do we understand what we understand from the research that this is what happens? This is the list of things that get affected by living in this kind of environment. Do we know why?
Well, I think when you think about it, it's almost like I'm often more amazed at the resilient people who do not have this reaction.
Right.
So to me, by the way, for many years, I co-led a group in a shelter for domestic violence in my Jewish community. Mm. And at the beginning, I kept on thinking, you know, I asked a lot of why questions. How could this be? And why don't they just leave and whatever? It didn't take me long to morph into just being in awe of the strength of those women about how do they get the courage to leave and how do they get the courage to be relocated to a different part of the country and start all over again. I mean, that became the question. The why is to me easy to understand. You know, when you have the people who are supposed to be supporting you instead in some ways abusing you and letting you down, you know, there's a direct connection between Bein Adam Ma'atzmo, Bein Adam L'Chavero, Bein Adam L'Makom. They're all intertwined.
Right.
You ask about lack of trust in person. How could you trust if your only experience with people taking care of you is that they knock you down and don't validate you?
Mm-hmm.
I think with each of those symptoms, the more I work with these, you know, with these survivors of trauma, the more clear it becomes as to how there's a straight line between the trauma and the symptoms.
And the other thing I wanted to kind of underline is you talked about affect regulation, but also regulation and sexuality. And I think that we're very familiar, or probably college teachers are very familiar with the women who affect regulate their sexuality to a stop sign. But that, you know, takes, you know, a lot of work, which is going to be a different webinar. But there's also, you know, I'm sure you've seen it and I've seen it a bunch, and I think it's something for college teachers to look out for, is the affect regulation to the other extreme, where they can't handle being a NIDA. They can't handle the separation. They can't handle the lack of closeness. They need more and more and more and more. The typical prototype we hear as the, you know, result of abuse is, I don't want anything. But then we do have that, don't stop, I can't stop, with their husband. You know, I'm not talking about a sex addiction, but as a result of, I can't regulate that part of myself. I can't find how to just be in a give and take relationship, it nothing's ever enough, or something's going on. I'm wondering what your observation of that.
Yeah, and I'm so glad that you're going to have a session on it, because when you think about it, it really makes sense. You know, if in fact part of the trauma involves some kind of sexual abuse or even any kind of lack of warmth and affection, it's not uncommon for some men or women to sexualize their dependency needs. So sex becomes a way of connecting, a way of feeling loved. And when it's not there, it becomes extremely difficult. It becomes, there's the terror of abandonment and lack of attachment. So I think, and we tend to see polar opposites. Because, you know, some people who have these difficulties throw themselves into that end of the pole. Others throw themselves into the complete shut off, which is the whole, creates a whole other set of problems. By the way, not every time. Resilience often is
what
we'll talk about eventually, but resilience is often very much there as well. But a certain percentage of people have this set of complex symptoms.
Which I think that if you don't have a lot of experience in the issue, you've had a couple people, and then maybe they follow a certain pattern, and then there's this other prototype of how this person's now reacting to a similar sounding trauma it can be very confusing. Like, why are you over here and you over here? Somebody who's in the field, you understand that there's a range, but that's really kind of the ichor of why we're doing this workshop, is to help people understand that it's all normal.
It's all normal.
It's all normal reactions to abnormal circumstances. Right. But there's going to be a range.
It's probably the sense that I say more than any other sense. Normal reaction to an abnormal event, you know? Right. You'd have to be crazy not to be having this reaction.
Right, right. Yeah. And then you'll see somebody who doesn't seem to react. That's also normal, you know? But don't have that expectation to the next person who knocks on your, you know, whatever, on your door. And reveal something. So I think that that's an important piece. Yeah. How do we, you know, we've kind of talked about the event trauma, and we've talked about the process, really ongoing process trauma. Can you spend a little bit of time fitting in there the types of trauma, or our understanding where it fits and how it fits, the types of trauma that are the bullying, you know, it's sort of maybe ongoing but more intermittent, or the, like you had touched upon as a possible, but how it fits in here, that couple of few times of fondling by a sibling trauma, which may reverberate and reverberate, but is not the same thing as, not the same factual thing as ongoing penetration, sexual abuse, or physical abuse, or Where is that? How do we understand why that can be just as debilitating for some?
Yeah, and it's sometimes very hard to understand, because I could easily see somebody who doesn't work with this population saying, well, okay, it was just an older brother being physical 2-3 times when he came home for Pesach, and come on, get over it. You know, I could easily see thinking that.
Why are you refusing to come home if he's home? Like, you're making our whole family crazy over that.
Yeah, and the way to think about it is that it could be so much more. When you have a vulnerable kid who's the victim, and especially if it's happening in a family where maybe there's a little bit of neglect, or the parents are overwhelmed, so there's often other things going on in the background. Mm-hmm. What can happen is even just a few events of sibling sexual abuse, think of all the ways it's a violation. First of all, you're prematurely exposed to sexuality before you even know what it is, before you really understand it. Mm-hmm. What does that do to your sense of respect for an older brother who should be a role model? What does it do to your sense of having a right to feel protected by your parents who allowed this to happen, even though it may not be fair to blame them, may very well not know about it. But mm-hmm. For a kid, it's going to feel like I've been betrayed by my community, betrayed by my parents, betrayed by my older brother. Mm-hmm. And it can lead to a cascade of emotional reactions, feeling guilty, feeling broken, feeling permanently damaged. How could I ever get married? How could anybody love me? Mm. And it's not just the 2-3 times that the brother might have been sexually abusive, even without penetration, it's what it does to your head. That over and over and over again, you start to believe, it changes your perception of yourself, your perception of your community, your perception of your family, and it really could derail you. And it's not everybody has that reaction in response to sibling sexual abuse, but mm-hmm. it's an unusually common problem in our community. We have some evidence that's more anecdotal, but heads of Child Protective Services have asked me when I consult with them, why is it that you guys have a higher rate of sibling sexual abuse than other communities do? And I want to take my yarmulke off whenever they say that. Yeah. There are many therapists and from community who all they do is see victims of sibling sexual abuse. And there are different theories as to why, but you have to be aware of it. And especially if you mm-hmm. see a Tala who might be, open up to you about it, it should be taken very seriously, and it will need a referral.
Yeah, yes. I remember at one point sort of turning around and realizing, I'm seeing 5 young women who were sexually abused by their brother all at the same time. And it's not necessarily what people know me for. I have happened to have years of history working with adult survivors, but Yeah, I can attest to the fact that unfortunately there seems to be a lot, way too much of this issue, and we should not feel, we should not on the one hand feel, you know, like it can't be, and on the other hand not have the reaction of, okay, kids act out, you know, which I think that we ping pong between, but we'll get into specifically what is the right way to respond in a minute. Before we talk about, I want to turn to sort of the criteria that tells us that we need to make a referral. Meaning that somebody comes and there's maybe a traumatic event and or reveals in the course of a CALA class that there was some sexual abuse. And like you said, some people react and are very traumatized and somebody else might not be showing that. I want us to talk about sort of when do we know when we need to refer. But before that, I think that it's important so that, you know, the college teacher or Revitson will feel empowered to refer. I think that it would be great if you could give them an understanding of what's the difference. If I come and I vent to you, David, about the car accident in a non-therapeutic, you know, collegial way, what's the difference between that and going to therapy to process a trauma? What is different? What could Revitsons or college teachers understand about the difference of what's going to happen when they go to therapy versus what's going to happen when the person just tells them?
Right. Yes, that's the core question of the day. Mm-hmm. So what happens differently? By the way, I could think of a situation where somebody's in a bad car accident and they talk to you about it. And they're doing okay, and there's no symptoms, and they're okay, and they don't have any of the symptoms that we briefly covered in post-traumatic stress disorder. And they tell you, no, maybe for the first couple of weeks, I was having some trouble sleeping, and I was a little uncomfortable getting back into a car, but right now, I'm driving fine, I'm not having flashbacks, I'm not having nightmares, I'm surrounded by support and love of my family, and I really feel that I'm okay. I feel mm-hmm. that I'm okay. And let's say there was nobody badly hurt in the accident and they're okay. So fine. You know, I wouldn't put, there's a fascinating set of studies on bereavement. I know that's not our topic today. Mm-hmm. It's fascinating. They did a series, they summarized a whole bunch of studies on people who had been bereaved. And they found that if people were doing okay with the loss, God forbid, of a family member, mm-hmm. they're doing okay with the support of their rabbi and the support of their Rebbetzin and the support of their community and their family, and you then refer them or push them, go for therapy. You know, this is so sad. Mm-hmm. Plus your father, your mother, your brother, your sister, just please go for therapy. How could it hurt? We'll pay for it. It turns out that a certain percentage of cases, not only does it not make things better, people do worse. Mm. So if people are doing okay with the support of the community, let it be. We want people drowning in our chicken soup, okay? So that's just an aside on that.
Right.
That being said, before I talk about how therapy is different, if somebody went through an unusually traumatic event, like we talked about sibling sexual abuse or a car accident where, God forbid, somebody was badly injured and they saw it, or somebody's in a terror attack, any kind of real event that anybody would look at and say, that's a pretty awful event, even if somebody's doing fine, mm-hmm. get a consultation. It may only be a one-shot meeting. And mm-hmm. say, great, you're good to go. Here's a, you know, I'm writing you out a certificate of mental health. It can happen.
Right.
But if they're still symptomatic, especially after a month, we're told, okay, mm-hmm. Almost anything before that goes into the framework of normal reaction to an abnormal event.
Right.
If they're still symptomatic and it's interfering with functioning, here's what therapy does that being a warm listening ear doesn't, okay? Mm-hmm. It's qualitatively different than just listening. What a trained trauma therapist will do is they'll help the person going through these symptoms that we described. First, they'll help them be exposed to what they're frightened of in a safe environment where gradually they're gently take the hot potato, hold on to it until it becomes increasingly easy to manage. Mm-hmm. They're helped to understand how to find meaning in what happened in a way that doesn't have to derail your sense of safety in your ongoing life. It can take the person and give him or her a safe place to vent their anger, to feel reconnected again, and a whole host of techniques that are used to help them digest the trauma. Is like digesting an elephant, and you have to do it a little bit at a time. Therapist and who has to be a genuine empathic and warm person, not just somebody using techniques, will be able to gradually help the person digest this. And with that being done, it is qualitatively different from what a mentor will do, or somebody in your kind of roles would do.
It's more regurgitation than digestion. If they're just talking about it and the person doesn't know, how do you break it apart so that you can actually get it down? That, you know, the therapeutic person and process understands how to pull the parts apart enough to get it down. Whereas the talking about it and talking about it and talking about it is really just regurgitating up here. Would that be a fair?
Yeah, absolutely. That sounds a very fair way of putting it. It's a gradual reconnecting in each of the areas, you know, until and it could take some time, mm-hmm. you know, but it can be quite effective also.
Right. And so if we go back to sort of the criteria for when we need to refer, you said that, you know, if the person seems to be functioning, it's an event, and the person, you know, a month later, you ask them about it, and there isn't, you know, the sleep disturbance, the eating disturbance, the functioning in other areas disturbance, the flashbacks or the arousal disturbance, and they're fine. What are the things, so just to reiterate, what are the things that you're looking for that are, well, really, you said it. We don't need to repeat ourselves. There are certain categories that check it out at least once. You know, you're getting married. I know you're telling me that it's fine. Yes, your brother touched you, but you're really, really fine with it. You don't feel any whatever. Go talk to a mental health professional once, or know that you should maybe after you're actually being sexual. You know, probably before, but certainly the follow-up, if the person is resistant, is, you know, once you're being sexual, there's a difference between even, you know, I remember seeing a young woman who unfortunately had been raped, and I thought we did some really good work and that we were done, but she wasn't married. So I said to her, you know, probably when you get married, you're going to want to check back in, just because there's nothing to trigger you now. We've done this work, but there isn't a trigger now. So that might be another. What about things like...
But if I could just bounce off that for a minute. That's such an important point, is that sometimes things have to be reworked at different developmental stages. Mm. So you're working with somebody who is traumatized at a certain point, and they're doing fine because they got whatever help they need. It could be that at a new developmental stage, let's say it's the first time let's say you have a sexual abuse victim who's doing fine and is even doing great in terms of her intimacy with her husband. It could be that after her child, she has a kid or two, mm-hmm. and they the age that she was when she was abused, that could be a trigger. And very often, people who had been traumatized in some ways, they come back once in a while based on what's happening in their lives.
Right. Or there's somebody who suffered through this complex trauma of severe emotional neglect in the household, and they've done a ton of really good work, but now they're getting married and there's attachment issues, and negotiating that might, you know, re-raise. And I think it's important that, you know, the college teachers and Rebbetzins know, in case somebody's coming to them and saying, you know, because sometimes clients will say this, that they're, you know, they feel like they failed. Like, why are they back here? And they need to understand they're not back at the beginning. Like you said, there's a new developmental stage, and that brings a new piece, an extra, another piece of the treatment and the work. But the work is still theirs. It just needs that. That layer, whether that'll come to a college teacher or not, but I think it's an important point. Is there ever, or is there a way that somebody might be talking about the event? I'm fine, but that we should be picking up that there's something not so fine. Is there a way they might be talking about what happened to them, or you know, it comes up that you lived in a household where there was domestic violence, but I'm fine. And is there a way we can pick up, we really got to push, they really do need it? And
yeah, and there seems to be a total cutoff from the emotion of it all. It seems to be, as they're talking about, like almost like real avoidance of being able to talk at about it with any insight whatsoever. Mm. There's a total denial of impact, and they're just minimizing away. I'd be a little nervous about it, because those are the people most likely that in some ways reenact what happened to them. Mm-hmm. You know, that's one sign. You know, I'm reminded, this is a pretty unfair example because it evokes not such pleasant thinking, but my very first case, my very first trauma case was, I was at University of Pennsylvania, graduate school, getting my doctorate. I was in training, and I get a referral of a woman who kept her child tied up to his bed all summer, because she was worried he'd get in trouble. And the Child Protective Services found this, and she ended up being forced into therapy with this young graduate student who didn't know what the heck he was doing. So I asked her the obvious question, like, tell me what your thinking was in tying your kid up all summer. She said, well, my mother did that to me, and I turned out okay, didn't I? Like, a total lack of awareness of any kind. You know, to her, this was normal. It was like, it was, and now that's extreme. It's more likely to be, though, somebody who totally denies and totally minimizes, as opposed to somebody says, look, I know that this had impact on me. I've really thought about it a lot. I've had a lot of people who helped me through it, and I determined to overcome it. And it has to make a little bit of sense if there's a total cutoff. Now, it could be they just don't feel like talking to you about it. It doesn't mean necessarily that they're a bitch.
Right. They might have somebody, they might be talking to somebody, but you kind of want to hear that or know that. And then there's, you know, sort of more of the event ones where if they're not sleeping, they're not eating, they're having nightmares, you know, that's a clear indication that they might want to work it through and have some help digesting it. So let's talk about the role of the Kala teacher and the Rebbetzin in this process. Let's talk about what a good response to someone revealing a trauma, and what a helpful response to someone revealing a trauma, whether it was, you know, I just, you know, or I have this car accident and my friend, God forbid, blah, 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 or whether it's my brother used to come into my room at night. I imagine there's a unifying factor to what is a helpful response that does not provide secondary trauma, and what creates the negative, or what we would consider a not good, not helpful response, because it can actually be the thing that creates trauma, or at the very least makes it worse.
Right, yes, that's a crucial question. So, I mean, look, to me, the best response is one where you respond in a way that you really show that you care and that you're hearing what they're saying, and that you know, you aren't shocked, because if you're shocked, it can make them feel even worse. Mm-hmm. Instead, you respond with caring. Mm-hmm. What that looks like, you know, the key ingredients, you show empathy, you show concern, you show that you're being no sebo and chavero. Mm-hmm. In a sense, you show a certain amount of warmth and caring and truly listening, not allowing yourself to be distracted. Right. As you know, I know you've heard in other sessions here, don't ask why, never ask why. Mm-hmm. Ask what, okay? Bite your tongue before asking why. You could ask what's it like? You could ask, you know, what could I do for you? You could ask all kinds of questions like that. Mm-hmm. The most important thing, it's not so much the words you say as much as is that you give them a sense that you're together with them. Mm-hmm. And not only are you together with them and not only are you there for them, but that it's a workable reality to give a sense of hope. Mm-hmm. That you'll be there for them to help any way that you can. A study that I know you've heard me quote, which is one of my favorite studies in this kind of context, is they take somebody, these researchers, and they put them at the bottom of a hill. And they ask them, estimate the steepness of this hill. So the researchers find if you're alone, you see the hill as very steep. Mm. Somebody at your side, the hill is estimated. You literally see the hill is less steep. And the closer you are to the person at your side, the less steep the hill looks and the less tired you get walking up the hill. And that was an amazing study. And what it's the Tovah Mishnayim in Echad, but it's literally what you do. You can't overestimate the importance of being at somebody's side with them and being able to help them see this is a workable reality. Doesn't mean you're not going to refer them for other kinds of help. There's a lot you could do working together with the therapist. Mm-hmm. And very often women who are in a mentoring position underestimate the power of being at somebody's side.
Right. And I love how you're putting that, in that you raise this research and that you ask the what can I do, because that implies that I'm here with you, but I'm not taking over for you. That even if the person's overwhelmed and even if the person is distraught, you know, there's something about the trauma that was overtaking, and it seems much more therapeutic to have someone there with the person rather than the, you know, I'm now gonna, you know, catastrophize, I'm gonna take over and you're gonna be out of control again because I'm taking over, not because this event took over, but because now you're taking over. And there's something so much more, you know,
grounding. Yeah.
Grounding by about this concept of somebody being next to you and asking you.
And don't underestimate the role you play with giving hope. This is workable. You're not the first person who's had this. You know, the Hebrew word tikva is what's embedded in the word is the word kav. We're told, right? It's actually, you know, a cord, a rope. Knows that I'm here, and we're together. You know, this is sort of like offering assistance in a way that you're not twisting in the wind alone. You know, we're in this together, and that's like enormously, enormously important.
Right, and not going beyond them. I always think, when I think of reactions or appropriate reactions, I always think about a client of mine who had an incident where someone had exposed themselves to her and her girlfriend. They were walking, little girls walking, and this man exposed himself to them. And they went giggling home. And then their parents freaked out. And now it was a traumatic experience. Yeah. And she can kind of feel the before the parental freak out and the after parental freak out. And it was now a traumatic event, but she remembers all the way home giggling.
Right.
So, you know, the power of the response is so important. And I hear you talk about it a lot, and I really wanted to get that piece out to them.
You want to know where the person is, see where their thoughts are. And to the extent that you could help shape their thoughts to be ones of hope and breaking it down into a workable reality, it makes an enormous difference.
Right. So now you've been hopeful. You've been, you know, there with them. You really see somebody that needs some help. How do you respond? What is the role then of the therapist? The person, let's start with the person accepts the help, the suggestion for help, but still wants to, you know, be talking to the therapist and then whatever, keeping up with the therapist. Is there a way to be a support to the therapy and a way to be a distraction from the therapy that we want to, you know, make sure somebody watches out for and doesn't get caught up in? How can you be the best support of the therapy in that role of continued mentor?
Yeah, so the only way I know for sure to do that would be to see if you could get permission to check in with the therapist how I could be helpful. You know, how can I be helpful? My bias, you know, when I work as a therapist is if I have a mentor call me up and ask me how can I help this person, that's golden to me. I see it as an amazing opportunity to be able to have, you know, somebody outside of the confines of this office be able to figure out a way to be supportive and to maybe talk about, you know, it's not your job to do, you know, the guts of the therapy, but your job to give hope, to give support, to, you know, and then to give guidance on how to do it. Now, there are times that I can understand some therapists would think that it might, in a way, be counterproductive. For example, if the woman who you referred is in a place where she needs to pull back a little bit from talking about the trauma, you know, and here you're pushing her to talk when she doesn't want to talk. So you might get guidance to, you know, maybe give it a break a little bit. It doesn't mean you can't be supportive without talking about it. I mean, you can get, I think, very good guidance if they give you permission. If they don't give you permission, then that's fine. You know, then just do, you know, I would go into a mode of let them come to you when they need help, but don't become their therapist, just become their support.
And maybe even say to them, you know, you can give permission just for the therapist to tell me how to be helpful. You know, if you want to make sure that the therapist isn't going to reveal anything else, or, you know, you can be very specific with the permission you give. Maybe that would help encourage the person, because I agree, you know, being, if you're on the team, it would be great if we're both, you know, have the same coach or you're on the same game plan. To have two different people on this woman's team who do not both see the same game plan can be very, you know, slow things down, I think, for their process sometimes, or get confusing because they're hearing two different things. I see it even, you know, if I'm working with a woman and then her child is working with a child therapist, but she wants to bring parenting issues into her session, wait a minute, what if I'm telling you something that the child's therapist would see totally different because they actually see the child, or you're hearing it. If we're on the same team, let's make sure we're hearing the same plays called, or whatever, I don't know what the analogy is. So, and what if the woman is, do you have any words of wisdom? Here is somebody in pain, but I can't go see a therapist. I won't go see a therapist. It's not happening to go see. I refuse to see a therapist. And they still want to come and talk. And you know that you feel badly for them on the one hand, but on the other hand, they belong in therapy. Is there ever a time or place or way to set a boundary, or is that appropriate?
And one of the ways of thinking about it is, let's say you somebody breaks an arm or breaks a leg, and they say, you know, I could hobble along here, you know, or maybe you could give me a, you know, you could support me when I walk out of your office or whatever. But I really don't want to see an orthopedist. It'll probably heal on its own. Okay. Mm-hmm. And you know that this may lead to their being permanently crippled and they're going to be in a lot of unnecessary pain otherwise. You would figure out a way, so you would clearly, you would make it clear, look, I can't help you. I can't really help you. I think that it depends. I get very nervous about taking an abuse victim, for example, and forcing them into doing anything.
Right.
It's extremely nervous, and that could re-traumatize them. It's the worst thing you could do. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, depending on the severity of what's going on, you might want to, help them get to yes. Help find out, what would it help for me to help you overcome your fear? Can I maybe go with you to the first appointment?
Right.
Answer some questions you might have that make you so nervous about it. Mm-hmm. Can I go without you for the first appointment to see, hey, is this a decent kind of person to talk to? Mm-hmm. There's so many things you could do that might help get them to the point that it becomes something more likely that they'll do. I don't know. Do you agree that it's dangerous to push, right?
Even within treatment, you know, I can see that something needs to be talked about and something needs to be talked about, but you know, recreating the trauma of abuse by forcing, just, I agree 100%. That resonates completely. That re-traumatizing or recreating that forced trauma is but I love all those suggestions, and that does kind of lead me to that question of making the referral and how can we best motivate, what are the resistances? And a lot of times it's fear, and saying things like, I'll go with you the first time, go once and see, you don't have to go back again, before you. Are there other resistances that you find are typical that you could then, you know, make suggestions for how do we answer them so we can best hope to get somebody into treatment?
Yeah, so look, there's so many reasons why people are frightened. One of them is there may be concern about, he or she, the therapist, is going to see me and think that I'm, you know, they'll see how damaged and broken I am.
Mm.
You know, and just to help them see that in a given day, that this is what they do, and it just means you're human, and it just means you're having, you know, a human life where unfortunately you've been dealt a tough hand, mm-hmm. and someone or helped by this. You may want to find out what is in the way of going this. Are there financial concerns? And then there are a number of wonderful, gemachs that could help with that.
Mm-hmm.
Are there, hopefully, okay? Are there concerns that you're going to bump into somebody you know? That could be what it is, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I'm seeing a prominent Rav here on Sunday, and I knew that he was resistant, and he was resistant because he's so prominent, he's worried he'll bump into somebody he knows before or after. Mm-hmm. So I gave him a slot where I promised him that will not happen, that, you know? Mm-hmm. You know, I'm seeing him with plenty of time before and after, you know, before mm-hmm. and after the session. But that had been the hidden reason he didn't want to come. And then when I finally got underneath it, I was able, and again, with everybody, it's going to be a little bit different.
Right.
Yes, try to, and ultimately to recognize they may not be ready. I'll tell you a quick vignette. Mm-hmm. Years ago, I saw, there was a woman, a young woman, she was about 16, and she'd been raped by her swimming coach. And she was, and it was very important to her swimming. She was very, very good, and she was like seen as being almost like Olympic level.
Mm.
And her parents forced her to come see me. She absolutely did not want to see me. And I told her, look, I'll see you 3-4 times. And if after those 3-4 times you don't want to come, I'm going to back you up. I will refuse to see you. And that's what happened. I her parents were very upset with me. I said, look, I said, force her to come when she's just not ready. But I told her, when you're ready, I promise you, I'm happy to see you then. God willing, if I'm still around, I'll see you then. About 6 years later, I got a call from her that she was then in college out of town.
Mm.
She called me without her parents even knowing. She said, I'm ready to come.
Wow.
Accomplished more in 6 months with her than I would have probably in those 6 years.
Right. Right.
Great. And she did beautifully. You know, mm-hmm. she really did beautifully.
Right.
And that, and she said, you know what, if you hadn't given me this space when I was young, I don't think I ever would have been able to come for help. She's still in touch with me. She's now a young mother. She's doing great.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. Yeah. So there's a time and place. There's finding out the resistance, and then there's sometimes a person, yeah, just isn't ready. And I think one of the biggest helps for people is, you know, the what you talked about before, for them to understand what the difference is. Because a lot of times the answer is, I could talk to you. I could talk to you. So them understanding that there's a process that a trained trauma specialist or therapist knows in terms of how to pull the trauma apart into its individual pieces that can be digested, that's not just the same thing as I can talk to you. Because that sometimes is, if I talk to you, then I'm just somebody who talks to their Repetson or college teacher. If I talk to a therapist, I'm crazy. You know, so working through those resistances, if it's possible, it is really, I think, helpful. And knowing that you can do more, you can empower her to call up and say, how do I know? What's your process of comings and goings? And so I know I won't run into anybody. And some agencies or private practitioners have better systems and some don't. And if that's just a game changer, then we need to look for the next person. So that, and that's a really a helpful role that the college teacher Revitson can play in terms of empowering her to look for that. So lots of information, which is really important. And, you know, my original thought was, let's do a piece on child abuse. Let's do a piece on, you know, bullying. And maybe there's a time and place for that, but I really, really, really appreciate and wanted to do sort of this picture of trauma, because I think that it's such an important concept on the whole. It's not just about the individual things that are traumatic. I think it's really important for the audience to understand the concept, and I really appreciate somebody of your caliber and busyness to be willing and able and have the time to sort of lend your expertise. The last little piece I usually ask is things you would recommend to read on any of these subjects, trauma in general, or any of the specifics.
Yeah, sure. Let me, I actually, that question. And the first book that came to mind is the book that it turns out, there's a very interesting book that's based on a survey of 3,000 mental health professionals who were surveyed to see, what are the best self-help books that you recommend for a given area? So the number one book by far recommended on trauma is Judy Herman. You know, you may...
Classic.
Actually, who I know a little bit. She's a very, very impressive person and very smart. And her book, which is like the Bible, is called Trauma and Recovery.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very nice book. It's by far the highest rated book by these 3,000 therapists rating it.
Right.
And then second, the number one is called I Can't Get Over It by Aphrodite Mastakis. I'll spell it for you. M-A-T-S-A-K-I-S. M-A-S-T-A-K-I-S. And I just want to...
That's in what category?
Self-help books for trauma.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Those are the two that are highly recommended. I'm sure there are others, like Bessel van der Kolk just wrote a book called The Body Keeps the Score that I like a lot. Came out last year. Yeah. Have you seen that?
Yes. I've read it. You know, it's of a higher caliber in terms of language and, you know, so.
Right. But it it has some fascinating insights on the neurobiology of trauma.
Neurobiology, which is the new black.
exactly. Not a bad way of thinking. But if I could just make one more hopeful comment.
Yeah.
It's all the ingredients on resilience. And if I could I end with the Dvaratara?
Please.
Dvaratara. Rav Palm, who was my Rebbe for a number of years when I was in Tarvadas, in the base medicine Tarvadas. So as he was rising through the system there, our class was lucky. We had him for, I think, 6 years in a row.
Wow.
And one of the things that he told us repeatedly was when you see an abused child or adolescent who's somehow suffering, and you look the other way, among the many do-risas that you're being over on is the do-risa of ha-lama. You can't pretend not to see something. At the end of one of the psukim on ha-lama is hakim tokei mimo. You have to have their back. It's literally many do-risas that you're, you know, that you're somehow violating. But you often don't think about that in terms of not acting on abuse. Then he said something beautiful. He'd say, when you do help a suffering child or a suffering adolescent, a suffering young woman, and you get them help, among the many do-risas that you're being mekayem is the do-risa of hashavas aveda, because you're returning to them their lost soul.
Wow.
Right? The do-risa of hashavas aveda, because you're returning to them their lost soul. And I see that all the time. I see that when somebody who's been abused gets help, and very often it could be from one of you, and just somebody who believes in them and who's there for them and makes them somehow understand that this is something that they could get past and become a resilient survivor who's even stronger than the average person. Yes. Literally, you see the light go back in their eyes. So I want to end with that kind of positive note.
I agree. I Baruch Hashem, have the, you know, opportunity to see it as well. I think that there's a lot that can be done and helped. And really, the goal of this series is to make that as smooth a process as possible, that we get people to the right help, that we help them get to the help that they need quicker, so they're not discouraged because they've, you know, tried this, that, and the other thing without recognizing, you know, which path they should take, or somebody not recognizing which path to send them on, so inadvertently sending them to the wrong kind of help, and then that didn't work, so let me just give up. And so that's part of this process, and that's just a really beautiful way to end. So I really appreciate that, and I think everyone out there who watches this will appreciate that, and knowing the important role that we think they play, which is why we're doing this. So thank you so much, David. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Lisa. Thank you for having me, and thank all of you for doing such incredibly important work. Thank you.
Thank you.